Just about the 5 o'clock hour, you are listening to the Drive Time Radio Show on WGXC 90.7 FM, Big Vern, Slay Diddy. Diddy, we got a special guest in the building today.
Yeah.
Very special guest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited about this interview, too, man. Got to be honest with you. You want to take it from here?
Yeah, sure. You know, like we said a couple weeks ago after I came back from my campaign, we really wanted to do a lot more political stuff and bring in some of the candidates and the incumbents and people like that who are making a lot of decisions on our everyday life. So we wanted to bring that to our listeners, especially with me now being a part of the political world. So we got a young man here, Antonio Delgado, if you want to tell the people, you know, who you are, what you're running for.
Yes, indeed. Thank you both for having me on. It's a privilege to be here. My name, again, is Antonio Delgado. I am running for Congress in New York's 19th Congressional District, which includes the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. And the goal here is to replace a Republican congressman named John Fazio, who, in my opinion, is not working on behalf of the people. And I'm happy to be here and explain to you who I am, where I come from, and why I am here on behalf of the people.
So tell us a little bit about what got you into politics.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I've always been a student of politics. I grew up, you know, very much informed by the legacy of the civil rights movement and what it's done for people of color all across this country. And I think for me, you know, learning those lessons as a young kid growing up in Schenectady, you know, with working class family, and my parents having jobs at General Electric, they used to talk a lot about the sacrifices that were made so that they can go ahead and get a good education and ultimately get secure jobs. And I watched the benefits that they received by virtue of that hard work. A lot of that came, you know, through political unrest and the desire to want to be politically involved and civically engaged. That's how change happens. And my family, my parents, were the recipients of that hard work, and I ultimately, too, benefited from that. You know, we worked our way up from working class to middle class, you know, got our first real home when I was in high school. But we started off, you know, in some tough neighborhoods. I don't know how many folks know about Hamilton Hill and Schenectady, but that was an area that, you know, we my family was a part of. And so you live out a narrative, you live out a story that I think with good jobs and a good education, the whole idea here is you can work your way up. And I think what I've seen over the last 30, 40 years now is us heading in the wrong direction as a country. Those opportunities for young people of all races are becoming fewer and fewer. And people are angry and they're frustrated. And it's going to take real leadership to get us back on track.
Once you worked your way up and you were in high school when your parents got your first house, college, talk about college, because I read that did you go to Colgate?
I did. I did go to Colgate. Yes, yes. So, yeah, that was I went there. I played basketball.
For what those position? What position?
I was a shooting guard. Shooting guard, Division One. Case for those,
focus chest down a little, just a little.
For those who don't know,
free throw percentage.
Free throw, 85%.
Okay.
All right. You know, right.
Assist to turnover ratio.
Assist to turnover ratio high.
good answer.
No, I was definitely my first love was basketball. There's no question. I grew up, you know, a Georgetown fan. I was a big John Thompson fan and the Patrick Ewing days and Mutombo days. Those are my teams. My dad, you know, was a big Syracuse fan, so we had a lot of Big East, you know, parties watching the games. And I got to Colgate, and I was an athlete, but before I was an athlete, my parents made sure that I also understood that I was a student. And, you know, I was that kid growing up where after I came home from school, the rules were you leave your counter on the table. I'm sorry, you leave your homework on the table, and your parents come home and they make sure everything is done right. And that was clockwork. You know, that was exactly how there was no, you know, playing on the sports teams until I got, you know, your certain grades. And I think, you know, for me, that was a real way to understand the importance of my education. As much as I love basketball, I also understood that education to me was going to be the gateway. You know, that was going to allow me to have success in life. And my parents understood that. It put me on track. So by the time I got to Colgate, you know, I went there excited about playing basketball, but also excited about, you know, learning and the prospect of, okay, now that I'm here, how can I make my own way? Mm-hmm. You know, what are my passions? What am I going to want to study? Who am I going to want to become professionally as I move forward in this world? And so that was a great experience for me, you know, being away from home, you know, becoming my own person, my own man, you know, and of course, playing basketball. And in fact, my freshman year, we went to the NCAA tournament as a 16th seed against UConn. They had Ray Allen back then, for those who remember. We got beat badly, but you know, but we were there, and it was a great experience for me, and to be able to be an athlete, you know, in that school, but also be a student and learn and grow as a human being is one of my best times of my life. Those 4 years there.
What was your major there? I mean, I know basketball, as you said, you played basketball, but
yeah, you know. I came in. My dad was one of those fathers who really wanted to make sure I did what he thought was the best. and he thought, you know, being a doctor, even though he was not himself one, he always thought that was the most admirable profession. Mm-hmm. And he really pushed me. And I was, you know, like a good son, you know, prepared to kind of make that my path. And then I got to Colgate and I, you know, tried to do the pre-med thing and I was okay with it. It was, you know, I could get decent grades, but I found my passion, in a seminar called, What is Real and What is True. And the focus there was on, you know, more philosophical questions, you know, mm-hmm. the meaning of life and politics. Mm-hmm. That's when I kind of got the bug for politics, because I learned about, you know, our system of government and political theory and ideas, like what it means to be fight for equality and freedom and liberty and how all these things work together. And I also learned a very important lesson about our country while I was at Colgate, which is if you look at how other countries have been founded across the world, a lot of them have been founded on language or geography. You know, America came out of this notion of, we can be better. We have principles. Mm-hmm. We're aspirational. You know, we're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but our origin story, how we came to be, was about freedom. It was about equality. It was about, you know, this pursuit of happiness and how we all have a right to be able to pursue as we wish, no matter our race, no matter our gender, our sexual orientation, mm-hmm. our religion. That's the beautiful thing about America and the politics around that and how democracy can enable that. That's what really got me into the power of politics and the power of government and how it can play a real important role in our everyday lives.
I have one more question before I pass it off to Kamal. Mm-hmm. And this is just on your journey up. Did I read that you became a lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
How has becoming a lawyer helped you in the political field and to be able to navigate through the systems and stuff like that?
Well, you know, being a lawyer requires you to be a critical thinker. You got to be able to take complicated ideas. And I'm a litigator. So, you know, a lot of my work has to deal with advocating for a position, right? Mm-hmm. I have to convince somebody why my position is the right one. Mm-hmm. I have to convince, you know, a judge, you know, why this argument that I'm making is the one that he or she should subscribe to, right? So it's about being able to make the case, mm-hmm. you know, why a certain set of facts should result in a certain decision. And I think the ability to make those arguments, the ability to be a real advocate, you know, when it comes to let's think about politics, if you're going to advocate for certain things in our political world, whether it's certain kinds of jobs or a certain kind of health care or whatever the case might be, you want to be able to feel like you have the skill set to make the case, mm-hmm. to argue the case, and marshal the facts and say, okay, here's how we can ultimately deliver this outcome and convince people that this is the best way to go about doing it. So I've been trained in the art of argument. I've been trained in the art of debate. And so I have an ability, I think, by virtue of my legal career to both help inform people about certain issues, but also persuade people to say, okay, this makes sense. And hopefully in the process, unify people as well, because sometimes you come across folks and they might not necessarily agree with you, you know, from the very beginning. But if you can somehow begin to piece together how you can bridge the gap, that's how you build coalitions. Mm-hmm. That's how you build movements. That's how you create change.
Is that persuasion talent? Does that work at home with your wife? Or like, does that like you able to get through some things?
Listen, my wife is the boss. No question about that. Yeah. And that's all I got to say about that.
Well said. Yeah, well
said. So,
but I do want to say I do have twin boys, and they're four.
Okay.
And as much as I would like to think that they, you know, can be persuaded, I realize that they're only four. So that takes some work still.
Yeah, been there. So being that you grew up in Schenectady, you're not directly a local, even though technically you're still right there. But a lot of things with local politics is they feel like there's people that are transplants that come into an area, move there, and then run. Being that you're kind of, it's like a fine line because you're still right there. But what do you say to that for people who may feel like, oh, he's not really a local guy?
Yeah, that's interesting to me because I am a local guy in the sense that when I talk about my story growing up in Schenectady, and, you know, Schenectady is literally you know, depending on where you live, in the 19th district, it can be a 20-minute drive away from you. Right. So, you know, you got certain parts of the district, let's say out in Delaware County, you know, the folks who live in Delaware County are two hours away from the folks who live, you know, in Columbia County, right. Or in Ulster County or in Dutchess. Right. So I think it's important to understand, you know, where my story originated and who I am. And the story that I lived, which for so many folks in this area, in the Hudson Valley, is a real story and one that a lot of us lived. You know, again, growing up with a set of parents who worked for General Electric, right in upstate New York, the same kind of story that a lot of other folks have lived out, whether it was GE or IBM, right? That idea that back in the day, back in the late 70s, early 80s, into the mid 90s, a lot of people in this area, all across this district, in this region, were relying on a certain kind of job that allowed them to work their way up from working class to middle class. And for a lot of folks now, that is no longer the case.
Yeah,
I'm not somebody who pulled a map out one day and said, where can I run for office? Okay, I'm somebody who grew up in Schenectady. And oh, by the way, on this point, I'm married to a woman who was born and raised in Ulster County. Okay. Who was born in Woodstock, went to Kingston High School, whose mother owns a small business in Saugerties, whose father is a local accountant in Kingston. My parents still reside with my brother and his daughter in Schenectady. You know, this is home for us. We were married in Greene County, in Catskills. So this is all about coming home for us. And the reason why it means so much, and the reason why we're able to do what we're doing and want to do what we're doing right now, is because this is about home. This is about looking at the world coming undone around us and figuring out where we can be most impactful and how we can help people that we genuinely care about, because these are our communities.
Yeah. Well said.
Well said. Can I give him the clap? Yeah, I want to give him the clap. For that. He did. You know how I like the part when he just stopped, like, hold up.
Yeah. Like, I heard this before. Yeah, I've been waiting for this one.
My wife lost the county. I got married in the Catskill. We own a small business. I was like, he hit
him off. But you know, I have to say, it does get a little bit, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I understand that there are certain folks who've run in the past, you know, did not have any real connection to upstate New York, let alone the 19th. They weren't even born in the state of New York. So I get the reason why some folks might have concerns on prior experience. But just look at who we are.
Yeah.
Look at me and my wife and where we come from. And this is home. You know, we came home. And I think that's the big piece.
All right, let me give him claps, Slay. He deserved it. That was good. That was very good.
All right, I'll take some claps. Let's get a few more of those claps in.
Oh, the phone rang. Go ahead, Slay.
So we talked about education and your experience with education, but it's changed a lot if we fast forward to now, you know, 2017. Where New York is one of the places where we have kind of free college, but also there's this fear that a lot of the grants that take a lot of kids from, you know, homes where there's not a lot of funds that are in danger of being taken away. So what is your stance on a lot of our education system?
Can we, I'm sorry, do you want to take this call first before we answer that?
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, let's take this call first because I'm almost sure it's for you. Oh, well, we don't got to do it. It's gone. All right, my bad.
Yeah, call back.
So on the question of education, let's just start with a couple of facts that I think are good to hear. You know, back in the, I think it was in the 80s, during the 80s and 90s, Pell Grants, which, you know, are meant to help folks from low-income households afford a four-year college education, they covered 70% of a four-year college education. Now, they cover maybe 30%. So there's no real prioritization for higher learning for those folks who come from low-income households. That's a problem. Our interest rates on loans are still increasing. There should be a flattening out of those interest rates to allow folks to take loans out and educate themselves. But even before you get to college, whatever happened to the fight for universal pre-K?
Yeah.
You know, we got to start you know, from the bottom in terms of our age. And this is where people, young people learn the most. They soak up the most information when they're little. And so the fact that we are the wealthiest country on earth and yet we don't have a universal pre-K system, that's a problem. It's a big problem, particularly when you have a bunch of wealth floating around and those with wealth are able to put their young people in pre-Ks and in private educations from day one. And so people are already starting behind the eight ball right away because we as a country aren't prioritizing our all of our young people's education. And I think that's a very important piece. And then the last thing I'll say, we have got to get back to investing in apprenticeship programs, trade schools, vocational schools, giving young people hard skills so that when they graduate, they actually can get a job. There was a period in time in our history where we thought everybody can go to high school, graduate, get a four-year college education, and then get a job. But the world has changed around us. Globalization is a real thing. The technology has advanced. It's a more competitive world. So we have to be more targeted in how we educate our young people and more thoughtful in terms of the skills we give them, particularly when it comes to the sciences and technology, engineering, math. We are in the digital revolution. We have to make sure that our young people understand what that revolution is and looks like and have the tools to thrive within it. And right now we're not doing that.
Take this call.
Let's do it.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm on the air, I think.
Yep. You are. Live on the air.
Is this Verity?
All right. Yep, this is Verity.
Hold on, Verity.
Hey, Vern.
1 second.
With the hand clap. All right.
I got the clap, I know. Wow. It's an honor.
Okay, Verity, all yours.
Clap, Vern and Kamal. No problem. Hey, Antonio.
How you doing?
Good. We met before, remember? We met at Kaya's house.
Yes,
the event,
indeed.
And then you came to the Democrat committee. Yeah.
Yes, glad to have you calling in. How you
doing? Yeah, I'm just always budget. I've been good. You?
Very good. Busy.
Good. Yeah, I'm just, you must be, which is good. You got to run for this thing. So I just want to hear more about some of your positions, as always.
Absolutely.
So I would love to get in the weeds about the political philosophy stuff you're talking about, but I won't do that right now. We can do that another time. that's always fun. But more relevantly, I think I'd probably just, I want to hear about more from you about the hip-hop program that you did in L.A., like for a little bit. I believe it was in L.A.
Yeah.
I just want to hear more about that because you kind of touched on that, but I never got to learn that much about that.
Yeah, and, no. I appreciate that question. And
I don't know how long you did it or exactly what it involved. And it was intriguing as a departure from your corporate law life. And
absolutely.
Also your local boy life. So I just want to hear what that entails.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. So basically, after law school, I spent a lot of time when I was in law school thinking about how to use the law in a way to bring about real change. When I graduated from law school, I thought I was not inclined at that point to just go ahead and go work at a law firm. I really wanted to figure out how I could use my skill set in a way to inspire young people. And not a lot of young people, I should say, from the communities that I grew up in end up going to, you know, a school like Colgate or becoming a Rhodes Scholar and studying overseas at Oxford or, you know, getting a law degree from Harvard. I mean, these are things that when I was growing up, you know, my family you know, we weren't thinking about me studying at Oxford, right? So I think for me it was, how do I tell my story in the culture, in hip-hop culture in particular, a culture that I've grown incredibly fond of over the years, in part because of its own history, a culture mm-hmm. that came from the margins, you know, a culture where a lot of young people were trying to identify their own voice.
That's what intrigued me, because I can relate to all of the above.
Exactly. And so for me, I had a partner who I had, who was a friend of mine from school, and we decided we're going to form our own music company and work with young folks around the culture, both in terms of after-school programs, but also in terms of our own catalog of music, where we can talk about the issues of the day. And at that time, it was, you know, stuff about the Iraq War or even things like Katrina, but just focusing on how to take the culture and take the music and the art form in a direction that had a more political feel and educated its listeners in a way to get them empowered and believing in their own power. Because a lot of times what happens is you got young folks who don't feel like they're being spoken to in a language that's familiar to them and that's relatable to them. And I can relate to that. And so it was for me trying to figure out how to inspire young people within what we all know now is the most popular art form in the world, that is hip-hop culture. How do we speak to folks through that language and get people excited about it?
And then you just leverage your, like, law skills to manage to, like, help with that part of it, kind of. But you also just, I mean, I hope you weren't recording these songs yourself. I mean, no offense, but
I think I was everything. I was both.
You were doing all aspects.
I was doing all aspects, and I think it's critically important to be a voice in every way you can be. And for me, the opportunity to be able to speak for and on behalf of the community through the art form was incredibly rewarding. And I think it also had the ability to inspire, you know, a lot of young people.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, to me, when you mentioned that just in passing, I was just kind of so intrigued with that and wanting to know, like, how exactly, right after you finished Harvard Law School, you went off and did this hip-hop thing, like, whatever it was. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, and
how long did that last?
That was for 5 years, you know.
Wow.
And that was,
okay.
And it was not a. It was a sort of thing where, you know, it took a lot of heart, and it took a lot of sacrifice, but it was for a higher purpose, a higher cause, you know. And I think if you look at my life and how I've gone about it, I've always tried to lead an authentic life, one that felt real and was tied to my own personal story and what I truly believed in. And I think for me at that time, even though I was not making any money, I was at times working very hard to get by with odd-end jobs, because I was really focusing on music and focusing on enriching young people's lives
and giving back.
That was my way of giving back. That was my community outreach. And I'm proud of it, and I did it for, like I said, 5 years. So
yeah.
Awesome.
That was something we actually didn't even know.
Yeah.
So thank you for that question, Verity, and thank you for calling in. I mean, your insight is important as someone who's a part of the Democratic Committee. So we want to thank you for this call as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm not even asking as a member of the Democrat Committee. I'm asking more based on just a comment I heard at another event, which, you know, but either way, thank you.
Yeah, it's always great to get an extra fact.
But I'm just saying, like, you know, I hear these things sometimes, like, you mentioned it on a passing, and I want to know more about it, you know?
And thank you.
I'm really interested in hearing that. It's a side that you don't probably highlight as much in presentations, like, to the Democrat Committee and so forth. But, like, to me, it was one of the most interesting things. And it ties back to your interest in political philosophy and leading a purposeful life in a way.
No, you know? I totally appreciate.
Justice,
I totally
freedom.
Appreciate that. Absolutely, and I think understand.
Principle.
Yes, and I think being able to be an advocate, and this goes back to the earlier question about, you know, as a lawyer, my skills and how it's helped me in the political realm.
Mm-hmm.
I think I fundamentally, you know, try to be an advocate, whether it's an advocate for young people around hip hop music, or whether it's an advocate, and you know, as a lawyer. To me, that's what I've always tried to be, is to be a voice, to be a leader, to engage in issues and help people move in the direction that I think we all can benefit from.
Yeah, thank you so much, Verity.
Thank you. Well, thanks, guys.
Continue
thanks
to tune in.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Good talking to you.
Yep.
Let me give her the clap.
Mm-hmm.
Verity. We appreciate her calling in.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Slay, what I want to do is I want to take a break, if that's cool with everybody. Yeah, yeah. You know what I'm saying? We'll take a break. We'll come back, and I want to talk about some hot topics.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So
we'll
take a break. You're listening to the Drive Time Radio Show on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, Catskill, and we will be right back. We back, man. Listen, this interview is going just like I thought. I can't say just like I thought. It's going a little bit better, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So Slay, do you want to start? Because I want to go on some hot topics, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'll start it out.
Okay.
So one of the big just things that you can eyeball when you see all the candidates lined up that are running for this district is that they're all men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how do we speak for, you know, the women and women's rights and different things that are big topics right now in our nation?
Yes, absolutely. I certainly appreciate that question. And, you know, I do want to shout out Sue Sullivan, who at one time was a candidate, you know, for Congress. And it's a testament to what's going on right now across the country. You look at the sort of pushback that we're seeing with the misogyny that has infected our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the litany of sexual harassment allegations that are coming to the surface and admissions. Okay, these aren't just allegations. These are admissions by men saying, yes, I did wrong here. And it speaks to how institutionalized and how systemic this problem is for women. And it's a real moment in our history in terms of pushing the agenda for women forward and prioritizing it in a way that it ought to be prioritized. It defies reason.
Mm-hmm.
To think that we are still living in a country where women have to still fight for equal pay, pay for equal work.
Mm-hmm.
That blows my mind. It blows my mind that we have a Congress that literally put together a health care bill in which it essentially made it a pre-existing condition to be a woman. You know, if you were pregnant at one time, if you've been sexually assaulted at one time, these could be construed as pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is just blows my mind, right?
Yeah.
So this is the dynamic that we have, not to mention the fact that we have the individuals writing that piece of legislation were a bunch of men in a closed-off room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so men who are going to dictate the terms of how women can take care of themselves and make their own life choices, their own health decisions, those choices are being made by men in a closed-off room.
Mm-hmm.
In the 21st century right here in America. Okay, so that is a problem. And if you look at Congressman Fazio's record on this issue, let's look at it.
Yeah.
When he was a state assemblyman, how did he vote on equal pay for equal work? He didn't vote for it. Okay, what did he call Roe v. Wade? A black mark on the country. When he promised to not defund Planned Parenthood, what did he do? Went ahead and voted for a bill that defunds Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
And then went ahead and voted for the American Health Care Act. He is not a friend to women. And I can promise that I will be. I am very much, particularly as an individual, while I'm not a woman, I'm an African American. And I understand, you know, what it's like to have to fight for access, have to fight for equality,
mm-hmm.
have to fight to be heard. And I joined in this fight. And we men of all races must join in this fight. It's not just about women taking this fight up. It's about men joining this fight too. And speaking to our young boys about how to treat women, how to respect and talk to women and little girls. That is our mission too. I got two little boys at home.
Mm-hmm.
They're 4 years old. And I make it imperative for me to let them know and understand that just like they're strong, little girls are strong. And they have a voice too. And to respect and be kind and be sweet. This is how we have to build our men up. And we are living in a culture right now that for too long has not done that. And mm-hmm. so for me, yes, we do not have a woman running for Congress, but I can guarantee you this. You got a man who's running in me who will fight for the cause of women.
I like that. I got to give him a clap. Mm-hmm. He broke that down, too.
Yeah.
You get the clap for that one. Yeah.
I like the clap. You know, I'm going to start feeling a certain way if I don't get the clap.
I'm going to get this out here right now before Kamal tries to throw me under the bus. Now, normally, I would want to give you the applause. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let Kamal go ahead and have his little piece on this.
Go ahead. It's my turn?
It's your turn.
So when we first started the show, we brought in the clap. That was our very first feature that we had. We got a ton now. But that's something that grew with us since we was in his living room all the way to the show now. So when we started getting guests like yourself who have big titles and stuff like that.
A lawyer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Congress candidate? Yeah. He wanted to change it from the clap to the applause.
No, I didn't want
to
change it.
He just wanted to move it a little bit for certain guests. And I was like, nah, like this is home, so we got to continue to call it what it is, the clap. He got Hollywood on us. Yeah,
Well, you know, as long as you say the clap, and then it's followed by hand clapping, I think it all makes sense.
There it is.
I just wanted to get that out there because he would mention it. Let's talk about the environment. I mean, living in this area, the Hudson Valley, the environment is a large reason why a lot of people live here. You know, they love the scenery and stuff like that. What is your take on the environment?
Absolutely. We have to protect it. You know, there's been a struggle that's been happening for a number of years now. There still is, obviously, the fossil fuel industry. Which for many, many generations dominated commerce in our economy. But as we've been able to evolve and grow as people and become more informed about our economy, I'm sorry, about our environment and our technology and renewable energy sources like sun and wind and, you know, heat below the surface of the these are tides, waves. There are a lot of ways in which we can harness our natural resources for energy. And there should be a trend, a shift away from relying on outdated, outmoded sources of energy like fossil fuels, which put our environment at real risk and ultimately are undoubtedly, as the science has proven, causes of climate change. We have to begin to move away from that and incentivize behavior around investing in renewable energy sources. That means no longer subsidizing or giving tax credits to companies like Exxon, which, by the way, pays, I think, something like 17.6% in a corporate tax rate, even though it should be 35% because of tax breaks and subsidies it receives from the federal government. How about we take some of those tax credits and give those to companies who are investing in renewable energy so that we can move our way to the future? Mm-hmm. The other thing that gets lost about this sometimes is people like to argue, well, when you protect the environment, that also can maybe undermine job creation. It's the exact opposite. The fastest growing industries right now are in the renewable energy space. Investment in solar, investment in wind creates jobs across the district. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly important. And I also want to point this out. A lot of folks talk about, you know, how many farms we have all across the district, hundreds of them. We have a real natural advantage here with regards to, I'm getting a lot of feedback there. Is that me?
Yeah. Okay. Somebody's phone.
We have a real natural advantages here when it comes to our land and protecting that land and keeping our waters and our land healthy and free from pollution is absolutely critical because that's essentially the source of our economy. Mm-hmm. We have to get to a place where we can grow our foods at a level and at a scale that can help us reach not just the folks within the surrounding community, but even downstate. There are $600 million of unmet demand right now in New York City because we don't have the infrastructure locally to empower our local farmers. But again, it all comes back to the environment in that without clean air, without clean water, we're not going to be able to produce in the way we ought to produce and leverage our natural resources. So all that is critically important. It's critically important from an aesthetic standpoint, from a moral standpoint in terms of life and protecting life, and also from an economic standpoint in terms of job creation.
Mm-hmm. Well, like it, Slim.
Yeah.
You next.
So another hot topic is healthcare.
Absolutely.
Probably one of the hottest topics. What's your stance on healthcare?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I always want to, you know, try to make sure folks understand how I come at this from a personal standpoint first because mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with a mother who almost lost her life when she was very little to rheumatic fever. And she came down with a serious heart condition that, you know, she was afflicted with for most of her life. And then she ended up having to have open heart surgery when I was in college. So, you know, the idea that at one time when she was a young girl, this heart condition that she sustained was viewed as a pre-existing condition, which ultimately could have priced her out of the market.
Yeah.
It's a sad thought. Mm-hmm. And I take it personally that all people have had to go through that for some point in time. And the fact that the ACA was such a critical step in the right direction to make sure that we get beyond that argument and really open up and try to really make sure that as many folks as possible are guaranteed affordable and health care and accessible opportunities to health care. Now, what I have seen as I've traveled across this district and talked to many, many folks, the question that we have to get to the bottom of is how do we make sure that as many people as possible are covered? Mm-hmm. We have Republicans right now, FASO included, who literally want to take health care away. They want to remove it from the most vulnerable people just to give a tax break to a wealthy few. I'm of the position that our fight collectively as Democrats ought to be, how do we fight to expand health care coverage? And now there are different ways to get there. You know, some folks will argue single payer. Other folks like myself believe a better option, at least at this point, is giving people the choice to opt into Medicare or Medicaid. The reason why I personally like that choice is, one, there are some folks who actually like their health care and don't want to be told, give that up, right? So you still keep them where they are, and they're happy with their health care. But then you also introduce a public competitor in the system. And that public competitor, Medicare or Medicaid, everybody else, if they want to, can opt into. And now that public competitor will drive down the cost of premiums, will drive down the cost of deductibles, and it'll make healthcare a lot more affordable. And to the extent it isn't affordable, the government can step in and help subsidize or increase the subsidies to fill the void or to fill the gap. So the big piece is, how do we expand healthcare in a way that it keeps us and unifies us and builds a real coalition to achieve the outcome that we all desire? So that's where I come down on it. I also want to point out that another big piece to this is the pharmaceutical industry. Okay. The pharmaceutical industry right now, particularly the prescription drug companies, these guys are literally in a position where they don't have to negotiate drug prices with Medicare. That's insane. You know, every Democrat should be fighting to make sure that Medicare can negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry. Prescription drug companies can pay generic brand companies to keep their products off of the market just so they can keep selling what they want to sell at the price that they want to sell it at. That's legal. That's a legal thing. We need to make sure we introduce laws that prevent that, that make it illegal to do that. Right? And so that's the kind of work that we need our leaders to do, is to step up and focus and call out the nonsense for what it is, and not get lost up in, oh, are you for this or that? But fundamentally, how do we expand healthcare and protect families all across this country, in particular in the Hudson Valley and in the Catskills right here?
Well, you know what that means. He dropped a jewel in there. Like, yeah, that was a jewel right there. I like that one. Yeah, that was nice right there. I didn't even think about it like that. Wow, that's legal.
It is legal.
Criminal justice reform. We got about 14 minutes. We'll have you talk about that. And then,
and then we want to give you a chance.
Give you a chance, just to go and, and see what you want.
But okay. All right. Well, the criminal justice reform conversation is a very important one. You know, and again, I approach this on both a personal and a professional level. I have a lot of family who are incarcerated, cousins that I grew up with, who I remember when they were little boys and innocent before the war on drugs got a hold of them. And it's broken families up. It's broken communities up. It's been devastating. And I've seen it. I've witnessed it. And it's heartbreaking, you know, to see what's happened, particularly when you know a lot of these communities who are suffering from this were created out of a system of oppression to begin with. And so the way people act and survive in some cases has a lot more to do with the environment that was thrust upon them from the get-go. And then when you have a legal system that only throws gasoline on the fire and takes kids out of school and puts them in prison directly, that's a problem. And it's been a problem for far too long. And I've seen it professionally as a lawyer. I've worked with juvenile lifers, young men who've been locked up when they were 14, 15 years old. I had a client who happened to be 14 or 15 years old when he was asked to go into an alleyway and by a bully, I should say, a 25-year-old kid, said, go get this other kid. He came into the alleyway, and next thing you know, the other guy lost his life. Now, that 15-year-old boy, did he really have a chance to say no?
Yeah.
You know, he had a lot of pressure on him in that environment. Mm-hmm. And our legal system said to him, goodbye for life, mandatory life sentence. Thankfully, the Supreme Court saw fit over 20-some-odd years later to conclude that that type of punishment, a mandatory life sentence without parole for a 15-year-old child, is unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. And that's a real change. And so a lot of the work that I've been doing, particularly in this area of law, is helping these young men in their resentencing proceedings. You know, what are the factors that we should be considering when they were that young? You know, what was their community like, their family life? Was there drugs involved? You know, how do we put their behavior in this proper context and give them a second chance at life when they've already served 15, 20, 25 years mm-hmm. for being, in some cases, at the wrong place at the wrong time? And I think we've got to move away from penalizing our young people who happen in some cases to just be brought up in very dangerous spaces, in very dangerous environments, and are given little opportunities. We have to change the outlook there and fight for a legal system that enables and rehabilitates our young people. And I think what we see, and I'll just circle back on this too, I think some of the ways we can bridge the gap here too is, you look at the way we talk about the opioid epidemic,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, a real one, a real crisis, right? And you hear a lot of, and I think rightfully so, language around decriminalizing it,
mm-hmm.
okay? And in a way that, to be honest, was not the case during the 80s, yeah, when right. you had the crack epidemic, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of similarities in that you had communities being devastated by a drug.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, instead of, I think we've now turned the corner. We were beginning to understand that people who are dealing with this affliction are victims themselves. And just throwing them in jail as opposed to a drug treatment center is not the right way to go about doing it. And it really bothers me when folks like John Faso will say, we have to deal with the opioid epidemic. But at the same time, he wants to say, I also want to take money and roll back Medicaid. Those two things don't go hand in hand, because the funds that go into Medicaid are the same funds that we use to do what? To make sure we prop up the drug treatment centers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some real hypocrisy there that we have to start calling it for what it is. So for me, there's a lot of levels to this, but I'm happy to tackle each and every one because I take this personally and I've had some professional experience in this world as well. And so I'm committed to the task of making our system more compassionate and more just for all people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we just want to open it up because, you know, there's a lot of candidates, 6 of you total, right?
Is that right?
Yeah, so I believe so. you would know better than me. But what we want to do is we want to open it up for you to just talk about why you are the right candidate out of the 6. And we just want to give you your space uninterrupted.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on the show. And, you know, this is really your spotlight. No questions. This is whatever you know, whenever people come on the show, they're always like, I wish I would have said this or added that. So, like, this is that time.
But what I want to do is I'm going to give you until 5:57. So you got about, you're going to have 4 minutes to do that. Because we do, the only reason why is because I want to ask you a question before we leave.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We're going
to take a little bit of that.
I might not need all 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah. No, that's fine.
I appreciate that. I really want to just speak to your questions. I think it's the right question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
There are 6. And I like the other individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing you will not hear me say is anything negative about my my colleagues in this endeavor. It takes a lot to step up and do this, and the times warrant people who have good intentions, who want to do right by people, to step up. And so I applaud everybody who's decided to do this. Like I said, it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But the way I break this down is anybody who's going to be able to beat John Faso has to be able to do three things: outwork, outraise, and outorganize. Those are the three things that any challenger has to be able to do. Now, I'm pretty confident that there's nobody in this field that can outwork me. I come from working class family. I was taught from yay high that I was going to have to work twice as hard to get everything that I wanted. And I did. I did work twice as hard. And my success in life, I think, bears that out. So I understand what it means to work hard. I also understand how to use that work ethic to raise money, because we have a guy in John Faso who actually is backed by the Mercer family, who's given $10 million to Breitbart. He raised, Faso that is, $3 to $4 million by himself, and then had an additional $7 million of outside money pour into this district. I've managed every single quarter this year to outraise John Faso. Mm-hmm. I raised $300,000 in the first quarter, $350,000 in the second, and $400,000 in the third. That's over $1 million, and none of it from a corporation. Okay, that's all from individuals, and that's work ethic. That's getting on the phone. That's making the ask. That's humbling yourself day in and day out to build and build and build. And then we're going to use that money to organize, to go to every part of this district, every county, all across the 19th, and make sure that the message gets out there. We have the resources to touch over 700,000 people and to walk and knock on doors over 7,000 square miles, right? That's what we're here to do. And fundamentally, you have to ask yourself this question. When you look at all the candidates, who is going to turn out the vote? Who is going to move people to action, inspire the imagination, captivate people's minds, their heart, and their souls, and speak of a higher purpose for what we collectively can accomplish? I think that's who I am. I think I have the ability to do all three of those things and do it at a level that the other individuals are not able to do. And I think for that reason, I feel very confident in my abilities and look forward to taking on Mr. Faso.
Well, well, there we go.
Well
there
said.
We now, Slay, this is fun right here. So I want to do this, man. So we have this thing that we call 530 Freestyle. And we usually ask this one catch question to all our guests.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know what question I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
You got to ask them this question.
All right.
I want to hear this answer.
So normally it's a whole segment of questions, but this is something that we always ask, you know, guests, first-timers.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you're driving home. You get two phone calls, right? The first phone call is a sweepstakes that says you just won $200 million.
$200 million.
All right.
Second
phone
call. That's a good call.
The second phone call that says is from your wife. She says she's in some kind of trouble. You don't know what, how dangerous or whatever it is. But you can only drive to one location. Are you going to go get the money, or are you going to go get your wife? You don't know what kind of trouble it is. She could have lost the earring, or could be something deep.
Yeah.
You don't know, but which one are you going to choose?
They over there hand signals, dog. I see it. And I like white money.
I tell you.
All I'm saying
I'll
is,
be honest, that's really not a hard question.
What would John Faso do?
Because at the end of the day, if I don't know the nature of the trouble,
mm-hmm.
You're telling me I have no clue.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got to go back. Because you know why we got to go back? I don't think $200 million. The lawyer, we got to take it up a little bit. We got to go to $1 billion.
You know, $1 billion.
$1 billion.
You're outraising. See, that's outraising John Fassel by a lot.
We got to go to $1 billion, dog.
$1 billion.
But that's the point, though. Think of it this way. Worst case scenario, right? Worst case scenario, there's not one that I want to experience, which is I go and I have $1 billion and my wife is gone. Right, yeah. That's not who wants to live with that. I don't.
Him.
Don't put me out there.
Him.
No, I'm going to my wife. I'm going to find out what the problem is.
I'm giving a little applause.
And then immediately I'm calling to find out.
All I'm saying is, if his problem ain't big, you better sue her. You a lawyer. Shout outs.
Yeah, shout outs. Oh, just to let you know, I said the same thing. I'm going to my wife. Wife said that she was going to get the money and I'll be all right.
Yeah.
Slay, what did you say? Yeah, you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm a, I told her tuck and roll for now. I'm going to pick you up. You know, I'm going to pick you up, man. And we're going to put ice packs of money, you know, on your bruise.
Yeah, shout out to the home team. Shout out to Nita. Shout out to Javen. Shout out to Avi. Shout out to Zozo. And shout out to everyone that listened in today.
Yeah, Slay. Yeah. You know, thank everybody for listening. I do want to give a shout out to Dr. Beth Henlon's office, because that was actually the first I've heard. It was actually came from my girl. I heard of Antonio, and I actually ended up meeting him two days later by, you know, some coincidence. So shout out to them.
Indeed.
Any shout outs, Antonio?
Oh, absolutely. I'll shout out the entire 19th District, all the good people of the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. I'm here for you. Let's get it going.
All right, man. We'll see you next week.